photograph on display at the Miller-Nichols Library shows a teenage girl in South Africa. Her hair is clipped short and bracelets go all the way up her forearms. She's got a huge smile on her face. Another photograph sits at her feet. A photograph within a photograph. This one is older. It's black and white, and it shows a tiny little girl looking as proud as the teenager next to her. The image, taken by Adrian Walker Horde, is called The Perfect Picture. Adrian Walker Horde is a professor in UMKC's Black Studies program. She's also an artist, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, she's going to tell us about her experiences in South Africa and what art has to do with Black Studies. I'm Gina Kaufman. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Gina.
Tell us the story behind that photograph I just described. Explain why it's called The Perfect Picture.
It's funny. I was there in 2007 in Mpumalanga province with the Ndimande family. They invited me to come and document their daughter's and granddaughter Judy's initiation. Initiation happens for young women and young men. Men are every four years. Women are annually.
What happens during initiation?
They go away to the initiation school for about 3 months. And while they're away, they are taught and trained all the things they need to know to be adults in the society.
What kind of things? I'm curious about this. I feel like we could use that.
Well, it's interesting. When I first started going through initiation ceremonies and seasons, I came back and talked to young people, seventh graders, about becoming adults. And I was trying to get a feel for what's the process in America? How does it differ from what happens so categorically in this particular indigenous nation in South Africa?
What did you find out?
That ours are all over the board. It's very scattered. Some religious traditions and some cultural traditions are very firm, very fixed. There are processes and activities that you definitely go through. But across the board, people were talking about wanting to be able to drive, wanting to be able to stay out later, do more things with their friends.
You get to do.
Right. There didn't seem to be a demarcation. And what I was explaining to them was that in South African society, as you age, you get more responsibilities. You get more freedom, but you get more responsibilities as well.
And so that's this initiation ceremony. And that's what this girl is dressed up to participate in?
She just finished. When you come home, that's the big time. When you appear back with your family, you've been gone for roughly 60 to 90 days.
It's a long time to be away from home. How old are these young people?
They vary in age. The women after their first menses, and the young men have to be at least 14.
So she's sitting there with a photograph. I think that's a photo of herself as a younger girl.
It is. When I was there taking pictures and we're going through all the ceremonies and I've just given her her presents, her mother, Helen, went into her house and brought out this little green frame. I had given her that photograph when I met them in 1996. Judy was 3 years old. And now she's 15. So she went in and got the picture and set it there. And she said, now it's the perfect picture because it's the young girl that I first met. And now it's the young woman that I'm still documenting and still a part of their family 12 years later.
How did you originally meet this girl? Was 3 years old is how old she was when you met her?
Yes. I went to South Africa. I was very interested in, I was doing an article on abstraction. I had interviewed abstract artists in North and South America and the Caribbean, and they kept talking about using abstraction as a visual language. So I was very excited about this premise that here are all these people, that's how I use it as an abstract painter, but they are using it too, and they see it as their way of expression.
What do you mean by that, though? How are people using abstract images as a language?
Well, take the Nzunza Ndebele, for example. Everything on their walls, all the painted images were family patterns. It tells you, one of the women in 1998, she was telling me the walls no longer speak. She said, you used to be able to walk along the wall and see the family clan symbols, how many wives, how many children, maybe how much cattle. The position of the family in society is expressed in the images on the wall, which are all abstract patterns. So when I talk with artists both in North America and South America, they're talking about using these forms as their language. This is how they express about their life. So I was looking for...
And just tell you who they are.
And what they're feeling, what they're experiencing. So I was looking for a symbol source, and a friend of mine, Keith, now deceased, was on the election review team in 1994, and he went back in 95. And he brought me a book, Christmas of 95, and he said, this is who you're looking for. It was a book about Nzunza Ndebele, written by a journalist in South Africa. So I started researching. I started applying for grants. Nobody paid me any attention, and so I self-funded my first couple of trips, and I just went. I talked to another friend, now also deceased, who was a part of a Mensa group internationally. She found someone in South Africa who was willing to receive an email. So I sent this gentleman an email, and he was working with the Peruvian consulate. And I'd been to Peru, and I shared pictures with him and my experiences, and so he agreed to help me find a guest house where I could stay for 6 weeks.
To understand abstract imagery better and its use in the culture?
To meet the Nzunza Ndebele and find out how they used abstract imagery. I didn't know they used it as a language until I actually met with them. So then I worked with Super Tours, the guest house owners, Roger and Elby, and they set me up with a Joyce who was a Zulu, but who knew some Ndebele, and we drove up there because she knew Mom Francina, who was the matriarch of the Ndebele clan. So we drive up there. Francina is in Scotland painting buses with her patterns, and she's not home, and she's gone for a month. So I met her husband and her daughters, Joyce and Helen, and Yvonne, and they just kind of let me come and talk with them and find out about their life. And I kept coming back, and I was there, this is 96, in time for the king's birthday party. They Ndebele have a monarchical structure. So they had a king, Maicha the Third, and he was getting ready for his birthday. He was turning 50. And so there was a provincial-wide celebration. Ndebele women came from all over the provinces. And so I was there for that activity, and I was around them for about 6 weeks at that first time. And so Judy was three, and so the Ndebeles were all in celebratory dress, and I took a picture of her dancing.
What has it been like for you? I mean, to watch an adult over the course of a couple of decades is one thing, but to watch a child grow into a woman is another thing.
Very powerful. As a person who has not married and has no children, I have godchildren, and they know I'm in their life, but I don't have my own children. So to see that kind of evolution and to listen to the kinds of things that were important to her, she wanted to grow up and be a painter. All the women in that society are artists. That's part of their duty as women in the culture.
Can you explain that a little more?
They create all of the aspects of adornment and expression within the society. So they paint their houses. A good Ndebele wife is going to have a well-painted front wall. And it's seasonal because the rains will come and it has to be repainted.
Painted how? I mean, I guess the standard house painting thing is like it's a white house or it's a yellow house. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a process. The women build the homes. They are adobe structures, mud, dung, and you throw the straw in and stir it up and it becomes concrete. And so the women build the whole compound, all of the buildings, all the front walls, the gates, everything. So then there's a prayer process, and the prayer process is the whitewash. It's kaolin. I've been with the women where they chip the kaolin out of the rock, make it into fine powder, and mix it with a solution. I thought it was water, but it's not water. It's a solution. And they mix that, and then they paint the entire structures white. That's a prayer for the family. These women, all the artwork is a prayer process. Even today in their commodity issue, it's still a process. So they paint the walls, and then all the family patterns, all the expressions about that family, Ndebele clan has what I call a linked box pattern. So if you see that, then you know they're part of that family clan. When I visited with Mlashangu in Nabo. The Nabo district is in another province. It's in Limpopo. It's a little protected area for Nzunza Ndebele around Pede and Sutu. And so in that province, I rode around with the ladies. They took me on different roads to see different houses. Every adult matriarch woman has the say-so of the patterning of the walls and the home. She may have all the other women help her. You know, she decides it. She draws it out, and then they'll come in and kind of fill in the black lines and paint when she allows them. And so that was what Judy wanted to do as a little girl. She would be practicing her lines, and that's what she wanted to be able to do. They also do beading. All of the beading also is a prayer process for all of the people in their families. And so now in the marketplace, I'm sitting with the women, and they're saying the same prayer mantra process, even for commodity products. And when I would ask Miss Sarah about it, she'd say, I don't have any other way to do it. I don't know how any other way.
You know, you've mentioned commodities a couple of times. What is it that you're referring to there?
Well, when I met these women in 96, they had nothing to sell me. Everything that they made in art form was for personal family use. They didn't have things out on a desk that you could purchase. They wanted to give me things. I gave them things, but there was no sale intent. Everything was family intent. Kind of a love.
Communicative.
Yes. But now things are made for commodity. You see them in the markets, and they've become international. You can buy Nzunza Ndebele dolls in museums in Philadelphia or in the airport in Virginia.
How did that change come about?
I watched the process with the end of the apartheid era. When I met people in 1996, I met many people who did not know that they were free yet. It kind of reminded me of Juneteenth in America, where here you have people who are no longer having to be indentured servants and farmhands, and they didn't know it. So several people did leave those farms and set up their own homesteads. So at that point, you don't have the government subsidies to various indigenous groups now, the townships, the Bantu townships, where they're keeping all of the indigenous black Africans away from the major cities. Well, when that indigenous supplement stopped coming from the government, people began to need money.
Do you see, how do you see that change playing out just beyond noting that it has happened?
Well, that's an interesting question because it's a big discussion even in South Africa. I've been interviewed there in contest with people because I feel strongly that the people need to be allowed to continue their cultural practices. And I know they have to evolve as the society evolves. When I met them, they were 19th century. No running water, no electricity, very little idea about the outside world.
And being able to sell things you would think would at least in some ways be empowering, but it comes at, it sounds like, a cost, a cultural cost.
Well, number one, you have women suddenly having money. You have women being empowered because it's their products and their sales and their profits. You also have the intent changing. It's not so much I'm making this with love for my family. Now I'm making it with love, but it's going out. And what I noted in 2000 was the change in patterning, the loss of family patterns. The 98, 99 early patterning was family symbols on commodity projects. Now, after 2000, you see the patterning changing. You don't see the family clan symbols. Other than Esther Mashlangu, who is the most famous living Ndebele artist, she has maintained her patterning. She has not changed one thing. But many people have gone to more incorporative patterns, where you see some Zulu patterning coming into Ndebele work.
Is that because that's what like a tourist or someone would expect to be able to purchase? Or
That's one phase. I know when the Japanese tourists were flooding in and ladies found out they liked yellow, one of the bead sellers were telling me she couldn't keep yellow beads in stock. So yes, they are responsive to their audience.
You know, you have gotten involved in helping women create the work that they want to create through something called Homegirl Inc.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Homegirl Inc. is my own company. I set it up because I wanted to see work by women artists across the board have more visibility and more exposure. For years, I sold it on my website every year, the kinds of things that they would make, whether it was bracelets or dolls. Or I did a drawing once of something I was thinking about called a girlfriend pin. These ladies came up with a bead pattern to create that drawing.
But wait, what is a girlfriend pin?
It was just a pin with little girls' linked arms. And I drew three little girls with linked arms, with little braids, and they created the bead pattern for it. We sold them for about 10 years. Yes.
You know, you used to be the director of the Black Studies program at UMKC, and you said at the time that you were named that person, that it was important to you that visual art become part of Black Studies at the university. I'm curious about how these two things are connected in your mind. I mean, clearly you see a deep connection between Black culture and visual communication.
Well, I just have to look at my own life, Gina. I'll start there. But no, I teach courses as a professor of fine art and Black Studies. I teach courses in African American art history. And it's broken up into various courses. You have the 1700 to 1960, 1960 to the present day. And I look at all of the movements in American life, whether they're political, social, or cultural, and how art has played a role in those movements. So my students find out about slave artisans and all of the artisans from the South. Some trained in Europe, some stayed, some came back to continue their craft here in America.
Can you give me an example of someone who a lot of listeners probably haven't heard of?
Oh, Samuel Yarbrough.
Tell me his story.
He was Julian Hudson. Julian Hudson is a painter in New Orleans who was a painter from the Melrose Plantation and the Melrose family. And so he studied in Europe and then did come back to New Orleans to continue living with his family and painting. We can look at all the slave potters, Dave the Potter, lots of work in Georgia and South Carolina.
Well, what are we missing if we study Black history without studying these artists?
You're going to miss the social expression and the societal expression. I do a presentation on the Fanner baskets in South Carolina because they're very similar baskets in Namibia. They just are coiled counterclockwise, and ours are coiled clockwise. And so I always think about the slaves arriving in South Carolina and looking at those reeds out there and say, I know what to do with those.
How did you get started as an artist?
As a child, I was very interested in art and drawing all the time. My grandmother, I would travel with her in the summers, and she would tell people, oh, my granddaughter wants to be an artist. Do you mind if she draws you? And so I was, from a child, I was doing that. I grew up in Jefferson City. They had art contests in the newspaper, and I entered several times, and I won every time I entered.
Nothing like victory to inspire a repeat engagement.
Well, I think I started at 11. Between 11 and 14, I entered five times.
Well, there's a series in your current exhibit called Spirit Masks. Mm. And I may be getting wrong exactly what's going on here, but they appear to be archival black and white photographs of black men that you've painted over in vibrant colors. And so you often can't really see much of their faces. And so I guess that's the masking that you're describing. Explain what is going on in that series.
It's a woman. There are 12 of them there, one for every month. At the end, there's a photograph. The photograph is the one I painted. It is my interpretation of the Gordon Parks photograph, American Gothic, 1942. He took a picture of Emma Watson, who was then the charwoman or custodian at the Library of Congress. And it's a historic photograph with her standing underneath the American flag. She has her broom in her hand and her mop is on the wall behind her. And so he's got this photograph of this woman who is doing her duty every day, unknown to the people and very invisible. And yet and still she's in a world where she has no rights. She can't ride the bus. She can't eat. She's standing under a flag that doesn't protect her. And so the custodian in our building, in the art building, I was teaching at University of Missouri in Columbia before coming here. She'd been the custodian in our building, artist, for 13 years, and I was getting ready to leave to come to Kansas City. And I'd thought about her all the time with that photograph because she had that same resolve in her face, calm resolve. She would do her duty every day. I took the picture of her and I put it in the faculty exhibit, and people looked at her and said, she looks familiar. I've seen her, but I don't know who she is. So then when I was printing out the photo, when we took it, we shot it during her lunch hour in the morning. I showed her the picture of the Gordon Parks photograph and asked her if she would mind posing for me. I wanted to recreate it. And she looked, she shook her head. She goes, well, we don't use mops like that anymore, but I can find one and I'll bring my broom. I said, yes.
So you're in conversation in this series with Gordon Parks, a Kansas photographer.
Absolutely.
And filmmaker, actually. But so it's an interesting melding of academic work and artistic creation that you pursue. And I'm curious how you balance your own artwork with the study of other artwork and the inspiring of students. I mean, how do you juggle your own expression with your focus on other people's?
Oh, you don't sleep much, I think, Gina. Well, I am an artist, and I want to teach. I enjoy my students. I really like seeing lights come on and they're recognizing how much art is a part of their life. One of my students said at the end that, Dr. Horde, art is a part of everything. I said, it is.
Adrian Walker Horde, it's been a pleasure meeting you today.
Thank you, Gina. Thanks for inviting me.
You can see Adrian's artwork at the Miller-Nichols Library on the UMKC campus. Next on KCUR's Central Standard, a documentary about Israeli and Palestinian combatants who laid down their weapons is generating a lot of buzz. We'll talk about why after this news. I'm Gina Kaufman.
One day at a checkpoint, I see a taxi filled with children. And the driver is explaining to us that these are sick children. He asked us to let them go to hospital. And I said, no, these are the orders. You don't have permit, you have to arrange that. And then, and he's like, you know, his look was about to kill me. And at that moment, I got a phone call from my wife. And she's telling me, I know that you are in reserve duty, but I have a problem. I cannot pick up our daughter from the kindergarten. Can you talk to your mother that she will pick her up? And I said, yes, of course. I mean, what a question. And he said, I'm doing that. And I hung up and I called my mother and I arranged that. At the same time, my sight is on the cab with the children. And I feel that something is extremely wrong in the situation. I realized that there is a split here between me as a father, responsible and worried for my daughter, and me as a soldier looking at these children. I'm not able to really see them, that they are exactly in the same situation right now. They need a responsible adult that will take care of them. I knew that this split I cannot live with anymore.
We have the filmmaker who gathered the interview that you just heard at a transformative moment for an Israeli soldier who realizes that what he's been doing may not quite honor the humanity of this person on the other side of that interaction. Here's a story from an Israeli man at the beginning of a movie called Disturbing the Peace.
My story begins with my grandfather, my father's father. He was born in Poland. He was the crazy Zionist of the family. And that's the reason he left Poland in the mid-30s of the 20th century. He left his family and immigrated to Palestine. All his brothers and sisters and parents and uncles and cousins and aunts and everybody, no one survived. Z Zionism actually saved my grandfather. And that's the reason that we have a family now.
What follows is a news clip from an airstrike on Tel Aviv. But just as your compassion for Israelis begins to peak, you hear a similar story from a Palestinian. He says his family had lived in a Palestinian village for generations. When that village was occupied by Israelis in 1948, his family went to a refugee camp, and his grandfather, who refused to leave, was killed. I'm Gina Kaufman, and over the course of that film, we meet several characters. We also hear, in sometimes shocking detail, what inspired them to fight, either for Israel or Palestine. We also hear what made each of them stop fighting. The movie called Disturbing the Peace is showing here in Kansas City tomorrow night. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm pleased to welcome one of the filmmakers to the studio, Marcina Hale. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What is the idea behind this movie?
The idea behind the movie is really to be able to take a place in the world where a narrative is very embedded, where the chance and even the discussion about peace has almost just been eliminated, and to show that even within that region, there is a group of people that are holding another narrative. You know, the idea that if they there can hold that narrative and they can do it, that we can do it everywhere.
What is it that they have done? I mean, this is a group called Combatants for Peace. Can you explain who they are? All of these characters are Combatants for Peace.
Right. So the Combatants for Peace are a group of both Israeli and Palestinian former fighters who have come to put down their weapons and to join together in working together on a common shared values.
How did you get involved in making a film about them? I mean, your background, if I understand correctly, is in psychology, right?
It is. It's Steve Apcon, who is the director and producer, was actually the one who began the project. He was asked to be able to go over to the area because he is Jewish. He's very, he spent time there, lived there, and is very connected with the region. And he was asked actually to go over there and see if there was any story or anything new that could be told about the conflict, because the tension had been rising and there was really an idea that in a way that Israelis were getting, the Israel was getting a bum rap. And so when he went
like over, internationally getting a bum
rap? Yes. And so he went over there and he did a interviewing of many different organizations and groups. And at the same time, he and I were working on starting the organization Reconsider. And Reconsider, we were looking at two main things. It's really how we can own our creation and understanding that this life is a creative process and seeing that our capabilities. We ask for two main things. It's what kind of world do you want to live in and what kind of life do you want to create?
And that was here in the United States?
In the United States. And so when he was over there, he met Chen Alon, who he just spoke, you heard him earlier, and who will actually be here in Kansas City. And he said, what is the group Combatants for Peace about? And he immediately said, we're taking responsibility for our creation. And so we knew that they were very aligned with the kind of message that we wanted to create.
How is it that you got the really raw stories people shared with you? I mean, we're talking like a woman who planned to carry out a suicide bombing, you know, she was prepared to kill unsuspecting people at a market, except that she was intercepted the morning of the attack. And she talks to you about the conversation she had with her daughter the night before. It's about the most heart-wrenching thing I've ever heard.
Yes, I think the trick behind really getting the depth interview, and that's, again, is Steve Apcon, who, you know, when you meet him, he's somebody that you immediately can feel that you can trust. And he spent quite a bit of time with them building that trust. And when you're in conversations with people, though, there's one level of just telling the story. And there's another level where the story actually comes from their soul. And that only comes really when you've developed that level of trust.
So how long did you spend talking with people?
you know, it was over the course of about 3 years that he went over there and he did the interviewing. And it was, again, it came in with the different people on the, like, for example, Shifa. I was actually not over there for the actual interviews. That's why I'm sort of like,
right.
I go by my experience with Shifa because I've spent time with Shifa since then. And what Shifa will talk about is that what she really experienced with him was that he cared about her story, not in the context of the conflict, but actually what she really wanted to bring the message out into the world. So she was really focused on finding another way, that this has got to change, that there is another possibility. So I think that trust and knowing that the story that he wanted to tell was the one that they wanted to have heard was very important for all of them.
Talk to me. I mean, I want to get a little bit, for our listeners, just a taste of the kinds of stories they'll hear. So sticking with Shifa maybe for a moment, at the very beginning of this movie, you know, when we meet her, what we really know about her is that it's painful for her when her own relatives are killed. So it's sort of shocking when it takes this turn that she becomes a participant in the violence. Talk to me about her background.
Well, the background with Shifa, the main idea behind Shifa and what we can see is that people, when they are in very difficult circumstances and they're repeatedly given the lack of choice of feeling like they have the capability of doing something, there's something that's really interesting that happens to all of us, and that's our loss of hope. And that incredible loss of hope is what makes this kind of thing possible.
And you see that as a connecting thread through the stories?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And there's the other part of it is because what we can see is that on one side you see Israeli soldiers, and the other side you see they're called martyrs, and they're heroes on both sides. But if you switch it around, they're villains on the other side. And so it's seeing that there is the lack of hope on the Israeli side is the hope that they'll ever be able to find peace as well. So it's where you integrate that it's both sides that are experiencing this hopelessness.
I also, there's another character. He's a soldier, an Israeli soldier, who ends up part of a crowd of Palestinians who are trying to deliver blankets across a checkpoint. Can you talk to me about that moment? I guess I just want our listeners, before we get into the ideas, to have some sense of the people they're meeting and the moments that they're being taken through with them.
Abner, he's amazing. He's actually a professor, but he's, you know, again, he's somebody that goes through the ability to just be able to identify as a soldier. And we got a chance. He just lost his father this last year. And the idea of being so proud to be a soldier, and then that the transformation that happens is when he can see himself, and again, with the courage of the civilians that are actually changing the narrative and creating a different story and walking through what they've normally told is what they need to do, which is listen to the military and actually challenge the status quo.
You know, eventually, as you've alluded to, each of these characters goes through some kind of transformation. What do you think that these transformational moments have in common? Because the idea that people really who have experienced such hardship that they are willing, not just willing, I mean really motivated to commit acts of violence, suddenly becoming committed to peace, it seems like this moment is so powerful that would change them. Are there common threads?
Well, I think ultimately what we can see is that violence begets more violence, and you can see it in the world today. I believe that one of the things that's very common around all the combatants is what they'll talk about is that transformation is a continuing experience. It's not something that happens just with one event, but there are many people, and we constantly influence each other every day on the possibilities that can open and actually transformation. They also work together because the first meeting when they get together was only the beginning. They had to walk through a lot of fears. There's a lot of stories and narratives that continue to make it difficult for a peace process. And so what you see is that their willingness to actually step outside of their own comfort zone and do something that for them even feels life-threatening. And so I think that's something that they find that they have in common, that they actually both or all of them have to face members of their society and members of their family who will disagree with what they are believing is possible.
You know, each of these characters, we go through the process of them becoming sort of militarized in some way with them. And it goes kind of quickly from one story to another so that you get each story in little pieces. And you reach similar moments in their stories kind of at around the same time. And that beginning part where we're experiencing the trauma that people are experiencing with them. And then we're hearing them, in some cases, confess to things that are almost just unimaginable. And that without that earlier part, it would be very hard to have any sympathy for these characters at all. But then quickly, you know, we're taken through these redemptions. As a psychologist, what is this journey that we're going through?
Well, that is where I really participated with the movie a lot, was is how to create the story and how the story would move through it. And that, again, goes back to our work with Reconsider. There's really five movements that are in the story. And the first one is to really see that everything makes sense. That people are participating in things that are even not even in alignment with what they believe in, but it makes sense according to certain narratives that we're stuck in. So we wanted to show the narratives that created the possibility for the kinds of violence that we're seeing. And the next part is the awareness, and the awareness of how these narratives make us do things, how we participate in it, and the kinds of belief systems that are there. And then the third part is the owning our own creation. This is where they take responsibility for their participation in it.
Your choice of the word creation, I've noticed that a couple of times. It kind of surprises me because creation and destruction are words that we usually think of as opposites, and owning our own creation, you're talking about owning violence and, what I would often call destruction more than creation.
Sure, because that's what we're creating. We have a choice. And so one of the main ideas of the movie that we talk about is that when people see the movie, they'll talk about how it's balanced. And one of the things that we say is it's not really balanced because we never really looked for balance. There's an implicit imbalance in the situation in one level. And the idea of even trying to find balance in itself can be difficult and go right back into a narrative. What we were doing was to show a level of integration. And the integration looks like this. As you can see in the film, you have Avner, who's an Israeli soldier in the first meeting, who says, we realize we have something in common. The willingness to kill people we don't know. And then Shifa, who's a suicide bomber, says we realize we have something in common, and that's a desire for peace. And so in there, you can see that we are integrating, and we can actually own both sides of it, and so that we can create both destruction and connection.
Well, I'd like to hear from our listeners. If anyone out there has had an experience that brought them together with a sworn enemy and totally transformed their point of view, call us up. Tell us how that transformation occurred. 816-235-2888. We want to know what made you stop fighting. That number again, 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a second. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Marcina Hale. She's one of the filmmakers on a documentary called Disturbing the Peace that's showing at the Kaufman Center for the Performing Arts tomorrow night. And she's been telling us about the storylines of the characters in this movie who have all gone from being combatants to being really advocates of peace from either Israel or Palestine. These are pretty incredible transformations. You lead workshops also for people wanting to find common ground with their own sort of historical enemies, whether it's their personal history or sort of a larger history. How do those work? I mean, what kinds of things are participants generally hoping to process and work through?
Well, we have a couple different organizations we work with, and then we also have Reconsider Life, which is our workshops. For example, Hen Alone runs the Theater of the Oppressed, so they work with workshops there, and this is with the combatants. And then you also have nonviolent workshops that they work with. And then in Reconsider Life, what we work with, again, is those certain principles of transformation, which, as I said before, was at the beginning is curiosity. How do we get where we are right now? Awareness. How does this work? How do we perpetuate it? owning your creation, which we take 100% responsibility for what we're bringing into the world. And then the next part is to imagine. So if we don't do what we're doing, what else would we do? So it's the ability to actually imagine past what our current reality is.
Or and like imagine beyond like a multiple choice test that people may feel like they have.
Well, can you imagine a world of peace? Can you imagine peace in the Middle East? What would that look like? How would people treat each other?
Do people ever say, no, I can't imagine that? Because that seems like a valid answer.
Well, it actually is very difficult for people nowadays to do it. And it's one of the things we talk about is that there is Latour, Bernard Latour, I believe is his name, who said that it is easier for us to imagine apocalypse than the end of the current situation as we know it. And so the idea is, how come it's so easy to really imagine the end of the world? What stops us from imagining in this creative process a world of peace?
What do you think is the answer to that?
One of the things that we see is apathy. And because what you look at is that only 5% of the conflict over in the Middle East is actually, only 5% of the people are actually involved with the conflict. So the majority of people are not. And a lot of times when we've done screenings over there, you know, people will say, well, you don't need to convince me. I already believe in peace and so forth. It's the other people that you have to really work with. And it's interesting because wherever you go, people say that. And what we talk about is that if you really do believe in it, what are you doing to create it? And that's where you own your responsibility for it.
So just not committing violence is not enough?
Well, when you look at the world right now, you know, and even when we're doing screenings and so forth, the energy of hate is much more vocal than the energy of love. And yet when people speak up in love, it gives an opportunity for people to share in and to express themselves. We've had amazing screenings. We were over in Palestine and Israel for 20 days, and we had 21 screenings, all the way from villages into the city of Tel Aviv, and they continue over there. By the time we left, we had 30 other screenings that were being scheduled to set up. And so what we've noticed there is that there's a lot of people that really care about changing the situation, but there's a hopelessness.
How do screenings in the Middle East compare with screenings, say, in a middle-sized Midwestern city?
Well, that's actually really interesting because the movie, when we first finished it, was on March 10th. And we just did it.
Of this past year?
Yes. And we barely finished it for this screening that we had. It's just about 80 people. And Chaz Ebert was one of the ones that came to
Where was this screening?
It was in Dobbs Ferry, New York, at Jacob Burns Film Center, which Steve actually is the founder of. And we just wanted to sort of test it there there was like less than 80 people at that screening. And actually one of the people on the board, Laura Welsh, was there along with Chaz Ebert. And when the film finished, she actually asked us to show it at the Ebert Fest, which was coming up on April 15th, and wanted to award it the first Roger Ebert Humanitarian Award. And so this was going to be the first time that the film was actually shown to the public. And this is in the middle of America. And the way that this film festival works, which is absolutely amazing film festival if you haven't been there, is that everybody goes and sees the same film. And so you have 1,500 people watching this film. And we had no idea how it would play. And when the film ended, and we actually had the two of the combatants there, Ren and Suli, when the film ended, the audience went crazy. It was a standing ovation, and then we went up on stage, and we're just there just taking it all in. And then when it calmed down a little bit, she says, we have a couple of guests here. And she introduced both Ken and Suli. And again, the audience went crazy. And what we learned from that is there's such a longing in the world for this kind of feeling, for this kind of possibility.
Did you do a workshop associated with that movie, with that screening?
Not at that time. I mean, we have been nonstop just trying to complete the film. And then once we completed it, we thought we'd be able to take a break, but there hasn't been a break since then. This film has been going to so many different, we've been up at Traverse City with Michael Moore and won the Audience Award and the Critics Award up there. We've been up to the Hamptons and won award up there.
Can I jump in and just ask you, you know, it sounds like it does get a huge response, but yeah. Is there a moment during the film, like just yourself as someone experiencing these stories, a moment that really stands out to you as surprising and the kind of thing that even like someone who has read a lot of articles about what's happening in the Middle East, like this moment is something that you wouldn't understand without hearing this person's story?
I think all the narrative. I was raised in Ohio in a small town, and even there we were given narratives about the Middle East. I think in general for me, it's just to see the humanity on all sides has been what's been inspiring and transformational for me. And so there's the parts in the film that I really enjoy. There's one part where Chen is putting a helmet on Suli.
And Chen is the Israeli soldier. And remind Suli's us who Suli is.
Suli's Palestinian. He's the one who was in prison at the age of 14 is when he was arrested. He was in prison for 10 years.
He had gotten started throwing Molotov cocktails and escalated his violence to the point that he was, in prison.
Assaulted an Israeli with a knife, yes.
Right.
Yes. And so for me to watch the humanity and the way that they connect with one another, that's what you see in the film. It's simple acts that feel so profound just because you can see that they mean a lot.
It's interesting to me that you, the moments where people are describing why they committed violence in the first place are really the ones that profoundly stuck with me. And that's not because I'm obsessed with violence or prefer that part. It's because it's something I understand less. It's easier for me to imagine in a sort of superficial, maybe uncompassionate way, why someone kills another person. And hearing someone describe that path to getting to that point and then talk really candidly about doing it, that was what was strange and surprising and new to me.
On which side?
Both sides, every single one of them. When people are talking about, I felt like I understood something, not understood it, like I can't imagine doing it, but a person walking me through what that's like was actually much more, every single one of them, more surprising to me than a person realizing that they have something in common with their enemy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I think that one of the things we see is the imbalance. When we look at the story, often people can understand how we get to violence through military. Like, it makes sense that they would join the military because it's, obviously it's mandatory there. And so that story seems sort of understandable.
Well, I mean, even the part where there's a guy who's, he's participating in air raids and he hasn't really understood what's happening onto the ground because it's so far away. He sees that on the news and it
right.
changes him.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And yet but that is something that we do every day. If you look at the United States, for example, in this last year, I think it was over 96,000 bombs that we dropped. And there's somebody that's dropping those bombs. And they are us, the Americans, somewhere. And if you look at the military-industrial complex that we have built at this point, I think it's $13.6 trillion was spent this last year on war. And $38 billion is going to be going over to Israel in this next 10 years. And one of the things we have to look at as Americans, it's one of the things we talk about, is always owning our creation. So even for us, it's this ability, because this is not about the Middle East. Even though we're using the combatants as an example of what we're in, our narratives were stuck in, this is about all of us across the world. And the $38 billion then is going to be used to buy U.S. weapons. And that money goes to every state in every congressional district here in the United States. So it's how do we support it?
And so, yeah, I guess the next step would be for people to watch the movie and come away with their own takeaway. So thank you. Our time is up. Marcina Hale, filmmaker and psychologist, thanks for talking to us about Disturbing the Peace.
Thank you so much, Dean.
That documentary is showing tomorrow night at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, and there's a panel discussion on Thursday at the World War I Museum. It'll focus on creating peace out of conflict. You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard, and keep talking to us and each other on Twitter. We're @KCURCST. Tomorrow, Kansas City's Mexican-American community responds to talk of a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border and other news. We'll hear updates on students known as Dreamers as part of that discussion. So tune in and share your story tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so don't miss it. That's coming up here on KCUR.